I'm Zaria Massani with the documentary for the Richer World season here on the BBC World Service. I'll be telling the story of India's biggest business, the Tata Group.
We are Tata. We deliver you the world.
Tata has now become Britain's biggest manufacturing employer and has dozens of other companies across the globe, from China and Korea to the USA.
We move you.
Tata prides itself on being the world's most ethical business with a unique charity-based ownership model. In this program, I'll be finding out what makes Tata different from other multinationals. My journey begins at the new Jaguar engine plant near Wolverhampton in the UK, which the Queen opened last November. Its operations director is Trevor Leakes.
Well, this is the first engine manufacturing centre that Jaguar Land Rover has built for a generation. So we're launching our first diesel engine, and that's going into our Jaguar XC vehicle.
Prime Minister David Cameron came here a few months ago and he was very impressed, and he said this is exactly the type of high-tech, export-led manufacturing Britain needs. Do you think it meets all those criteria?
It does. People can't fail to be impressed. This is over £500 million worth of investment in the West Midlands here in Wolverhampton, with a total jobs of 1,400 when it's up and running fully, which equates to over 3,500 in the supply chain.
Will the British footprint of this Indian giant continue to grow? The Tata Empire dates back to the 19th century to a family business in India's tiny Parsi Zoroastrian minority. We need to understand where Tata comes from to know what's special about them and how different they are from other multinationals. I'm near Bombay House in Mumbai, the nerve centre of the global Tata Empire. Bombay House has some poignant childhood memories for me. My father worked here for a decade as chief of staff to the legendary J.R.D. Tata, who chaired the Tata Group for more than half a century. My school was just a few minutes away, and I often came here after school and played in my father's office, and often in J.R.D.'s next door. The Tata name is everywhere here. Indians are born in Tata hospitals, their houses are held up with Tata steel, and their electricity comes courtesy of the Tata Power Company. But have Tata become too big for their own good and ours?
For any middle-class Indian parents, if their son or daughter got a job in the Tatas, that would be prestigious.
Jerry Rao is a Mumbai-based business analyst.
They are, in the eye of the beholder, patriotic, honourable, committed to philanthropic causes. But in terms of the way they run their businesses, it's pretty much like anyone else.
So where does this prestige come from?
Because they are not a large family, they tend to treat their professional managers well, as colleagues, as interested parties, rather than purely family retainers or something which other business houses might be doing. So that makes them an attractive place from the perspective of a professional manager. I think they are genuinely committed to some kind of national mission for India. And the fact that everybody knows that most of the shares are held by trusts and not by individuals who are fattening themselves, that helps. And the Tatas who are around tend to lead relatively simple lifestyles.
I'm on a train to Jamshedpur, the model industrial town which Tata Steel carved out of the jungles more than a century ago in one of India's most backward tribal areas. We're travelling through areas rich in coal and iron ore, which made this the heart of Tata Steel's now enormous global empire. I'm talking to the passenger sitting opposite me. What do you think of the way Tatas are running Jamshedpur?
I live in Jamshedpur for 1.5 years almost, and each and every day I am walking. Evening walks is a walking track. You will not find a single leaves in the streets. They're so well maintained by the Tata, and we are really very happy with the Tata Groups.
It all begins here at Jamshedpur, which is named after the founder Jamsetji Tata. When Tata Steel began, it was really quite revolutionary. No Asian country had a steel plant of its own, and a skeptical British official scoffed that he would eat every ton of steel they produced. But he soon had to eat his own words, because when World War I broke out, Tata Steel produced the rails for huge new extensions that the British needed for the Eastern Theatre of War, and they wouldn't have been able to manage those railway lines without Tata Steel, so they were very grateful for it.
My name is Narendran. I am designated as a managing director for Tata Steel for India and Southeast Asia. If India has to develop, if India has to grow at 7 or 8% GDP, the consumption of steel has to grow. If India has to build infrastructure, the consumption of steel has to grow. The Prime Minister today is talking about make in India, which means manufacture in India. And if you manufacture products in India, most products would use steel in some form or the other, if not anything else, to build the factories in which they would manufacture those products in. So we believe that demand for steel in India will continue to grow, but we are conscious that good demand doesn't necessarily mean good profits. So we have to stay competitive. India is one of the most open markets for steel.
The big question is whether Tata can remain competitive while maintaining its ethical profile. For more than a century, Tata Steel has prided itself on the world's most advanced labour welfare, giving its workers and their families free housing, healthcare and education. The Tata Charitable Trust also run rural development projects in the tribal areas affected by mining. One Tata Steel advertisement jokingly boasted, "We also make steel." The keeper of the Tata conscience today is Dr. Mukund Rajan, grandly titled Brand Custodian and Chief Ethical Officer of the Tata Group.
I'd say value and values are both inextricably linked for Tatas. Our core purpose, our mission, the reason we exist, has been defined as improving the quality of life of the communities we serve globally through long-term stakeholder value creation. And this goes back to very much the philosophy and thought process of our founder, Jamsetji Tata. There's a famous statement attributed to him where he says, in a free enterprise, the community is not just another stakeholder in business, but is in fact the very purpose of its existence.
I'm in the village of Pipla, near Jamshedpur. There's a Tata Steel Rural Development Society running a project here. It's a rural training center which is running a self-help group for tribal women primarily.
My name is Dilip Castleton. I work as a head of empowerment in Tata Steel CSR and working for last 30 years.
Can I just ask you, what is the role of Tata and Tata Steel in making this possible?
See, our role of Tata Steel and Tata Steel CSR division is empower these women, organize these women, build their capacity, okay, and also introduce the literacy level. Literacy program, more than 16,000 women, and work for micro-enterprise. So they can enhance their income and then improve their quality of life of their and their family. People used to take only one crop, and all year they're unemployed. Either they used to migrate to the towns or they don't have any job. But due to this, what we have done, because of the heavy rain, digging the pond, we are also giving another for second crop, the cash crop which you take, vegetable they grow. So what happens? Income enhanced, and this is the second crop. The farmer says, give us the water and we'll do everything. So that is one thing which Tata Steel CSR division is doing.
These are tribal communities and they have their own musical instrument. It's called the banam, and this is a dying musical instrument. So Tata Steel, through its Tribal Culture Society, has taken upon itself to preserve and promote this instrument. My name is Biren Bhuta. I am Chief of Corporate Social Responsibility at Tata Steel.
Isn't there a conflict between industrial development in these areas and preserving tribal culture?
Sure, there is a conflict. Wherever industrialization happens, urbanization happens, globalization happens, one tends to intrude upon tribals and their way of life. Tribals are intrinsically linked with nature, and they live amidst nature. They worship nature. They are animist by religion. So one encroaches upon their territory. Whilst on the one hand, a lot of it is inevitable as countries develop and industrialize, at the same time, I believe that the onus is on us to ensure that indigenous cultures not only are preserved, but they're also actively promoted.
You're listening to Tata, India's global giant, on the BBC World Service. Despite these promises, there are concerns that Tata Steel is not giving back as much as it's extracting. Jamshedpur, administered by Tata under lease from the government, is run far better than any of India's notoriously corrupt elected municipalities. But all may not be as good as it seems.
My name is Divya Gupta, freelance journalist and an independent development consultant. I don't know if you took a look at the rivers in Jamshedpur, but the main river is extremely polluted. I think it would be unfair to lay all the blame on Tata's doorstep, but certainly in Jamshedpur, it's the main industrial unit. And the answer, when I asked about the river pollution and what they're doing about it, was simply that the rivers are not ours. It was a rather defiant sort of response. It was not one I was expecting. Certainly in the tradition of JRD's concept of giving back to the community, one of the other things I found in Jamshedpur was that there was remnants of a lot more that Tata Steel used to do earlier and rolled back on later. Ultimately, I think it came down to global competitive pressures, because one of the employees told me that once Ratan Tata came in to a meeting and he drew a graph, etc., and he said that Tata Steel is generating the least revenue in a relative sense and that they needed to really do something drastic.
You can't operate in the chemicals industry or the steel industry and mining without having an obvious impact on the environment.
Mukund Rajan, Tata's chief ethical officer.
So the question is, how do you mitigate the worst impact, the adverse effects that might take place, and how do you create correction of that? Let me give you a couple of examples. Tata Chemicals operates in a part of the country, Mithapur, which is scarce in water. They have, through the use of technology and research and development, actually brought their operations to a point where they have net zero consumption of fresh water and groundwater, which is unique for the chemicals industry in India. Take Tata Steel. They will show you mines where they've completely restored the fauna and flora of what was a mining activity that had diminished the support capability of the soil. And they've restored that and revitalized it.
Most environmentalists do agree that despite occasional lapses, Tata has been far more responsible and responsive than any of its competitors. Critic Divya Gupta.
Tata Steel, for many Indians, was considered the gold standard in corporate social responsibility. I believe that Tata Steel has buckled to global competitive pressures in the same way that others have. But it has a historical legacy and a loyalty and an intention that I hope can put it back on track to regain that gold standard.
It has never been the case that Tatas have said that they will always sustain every business that they invest in, regardless of the economic consequences. Go back to the point about value and values. Without creating economic value, we cannot support the values we stand for.
Now, the Tata ownership model for Tata Sons, the central holding company, is rather unique in the world, isn't it?
It is. 66% of the equity of the parent investment holding company, Tata Sons, are held by what are effectively the largest private charities in India. On average, the Tata Group and the Tata Trusts have been contributing in the region of $200 million a year to support social causes.
As Mukund Rajan emphasizes, the core shareholding by charitable trusts has a stabilizing impact on Tata decision-making. Philanthropic Tata family members were notoriously infertile and left their money to the trust partly because they had no children of their own. That made Tata companies remarkably free of nepotism, unlike most other family businesses. It's also meant that Tata's professional managers have been much freer to make decisions without shareholder pressure for quick, short-term profits. Business analyst Jerry Rao.
Their ability to attract and retain good quality management talent, engineering talent, that comes from their being seen as a fair and decent employer, not necessarily an employer who pays the best in the marketplace, but an employer you can rely on, where there is a kind of almost a family compact between the employee and the Tata company. Particularly the transition to IT. IT is a human capital intensive business. You need lots of people.
All of us are in the service business. It doesn't matter where you are, what you're doing.
A workshop at the Tata Management Training Center in Pune. It epitomizes Tata's emphasis on nurturing the talents of its managerial cadres. And it's this human capital that underpins the group's great leap from manufacturing into information technology. Tata Consultancy Services, which began in the 1960s in JRD Tata's back office, is today the most valuable and profitable of all Tata companies, supplying computer software and processing services to a predominantly foreign clientele. Its main selling point, says Jerry Rao, is its capacity to attract the best brains in the business.
I remember my father, who worked for the government of India, telling me basically that I should also work for the government, failing which, if I wanted to work for the private sector, the only one I should consider is the Tatas. I think that gives them an overwhelming competitive advantage. I think being an employer of choice is what has been their strategy from day one. And the employer of choice strategy allows diversification across industries, allows the creation of a conglomerate. So I would say, are they the global employer of choice for the 21st century?
That diversification and the leap onto the world stage would have been impossible without the wave of economic liberalisation that swept India through the 1990s, unshackling businesses from half a century of state-controlled socialism. Liberalisation meant that Tata companies could attract major new investment from foreign capital markets. And that allowed their new chairman, Ratan Tata, to go on a global shopping spree, which included Daewoo in Korea, a chain of foreign hotels, and Cora Steel and Jaguar Land Rover in the UK. Mike Wright, executive director of JLR, was closely involved in those takeover negotiations.
Mr. Tata's presence was very significant as the process developed. And his personal ambition for Jaguar Land Rover became a very significant factor in people like myself and my colleagues seeing that there actually was great potential under Tata to make the business flourish. Mr. Tata was very clear that it was for the long term, which was an interesting contrast to some of the previous discussions we'd had with some very good owners.
Did Tata bring something new to JLR management?
I think Tata brought a lot of techniques and capabilities, particularly in the area of thinking long term, investing in product, particularly in innovation. I think there's no doubt that Tata's history over many decades of having global activities has been a real catalyst in challenging us to think about our ambitions globally.
They have been able to come in and transform brands, you know, beyond belief.
Priti Patel is Exchequer Secretary at the UK Treasury and also advises the Prime Minister on matters to do with the Asian diaspora.
When the global economy has not been performing particularly well, they have been tremendous investors. You know, they've invested very shrewdly, and that's the key to future sustainability, success and growth, but also it helps exports too.
Today, 90% of JLR's production is for export, and China is its largest market. I asked Mukund Rajan, is there a strategy underlying Tata's foreign acquisitions?
Before we make any acquisition, We're very keen to see that there is an alignment between the existing management, the way the company thinks about its business, and the way Tatas are used to doing business. If that alignment does not exist, then regardless of what kind of brand you have and what kind of prospects it may have, we are not interested in bringing those companies into the Tata Group's fold.
Let's just bring you some other news just in this hour, and that is that Europe's second largest steel producer, Tata Steel, is planning to sell its long products division, which employs 6,500 workers.
It does mean big uncertainty, 6,500 jobs. Unions today saying they're very concerned and opposed to the sale on principle. They weren't consulted. They think they've been treated with contempt. And the
business secretary... Tata is a business, and that means making tough choices. And it's doing exactly that with British steel operations. Not welcome news for Roy Rickers, General Secretary at the Steel Union Community.
Tata introduced a code of conduct into the UK, which was broadly around the concept of their values and vision within India. We welcome that. What we said is we're going to make sure they live up to it. We're going to hold them to it. And I think up until recently we did. Sadly, I think the events of recent times have dented our belief that that code of conduct is worth the paper it's written on. If you take the announcement around the sale of long products, that shocked us. I think they treated the unions with contempt because we knew nothing about that situation developing. For them to tell the local officials at 5 o'clock in the evening that they were making an announcement at 9 o'clock the next day is shocking.
And the business secretary has intervened this morning as well, and he has said this morning that the sale shows the harsh reality of trading conditions in parts of the steel industry. He says he spoke to the head of Tata in India this week, and that he has personally reaffirmed to me his company's commitment to the British steel industry.
Tata Steel in the UK wants to sell off its loss-making bits and concentrate on more commercially sustainable business in Europe. The present Tata chairman, Cyrus Mistry, flew here from India for fresh negotiations with the union and promised further consultations. Both he and his predecessor, Ratan Tata, are notoriously publicity shy and refuse all interview requests. With a foot in virtually every economic activity, is the Tata giant in danger of imperial overstretch? There are those, like Dr. J.J. Irani, the very experienced former managing director of Tata Steel, who think globalization has gone too far.
I think we should concentrate our energies and our operations in India. India is a tremendous market for steel. Let me point out that at one time in the early 50s, China was making less steel than India. Now China makes close to 700 million tons. India makes about 70 to 80 million tons. And the scope for steel making in India is tremendous.
Also presumably far lower production costs than in Europe. So does it make any sense for Tata Steel Europe to continue? Should they not just pack up and come back to India?
That's a very political and very, I don't think I'm competent to answer that question. But looking back over the last 10 years, I certainly wish that we had put all that money into steelmaking operations in India rather than go abroad.
I think their management bench will remain largely Indian because this is where they have their brand and they have their ability to attract top-notch talent. I'm not sure they can attract the best talent in an England or a Brazil or whatever. The point is, if the Indian business environment turns less hostile, which I think it might over the next 5-10 years, I see no reason why they wouldn't rebalance their portfolio more in favor of India. Doesn't mean they're going to get out of the foreign markets they're in completely, no, not at all. But, you know, if it's now a 60-40 that way, it could become a 55-45 the other way.
The rebalancing that business analyst Jerry Rao predicts won't be good news for languishing steel plants in the UK, while new opportunity beckons in India's huge domestic market. Despite being so cosmopolitan in its leadership and aims, Tata's top management remains firmly Indian. Preeti Patel at the UK Treasury.
I think the most unique aspect of Tata is without a doubt its heritage. Its roots are firmly in India, and they have been able to grow, expand, just at the time when India has emerged as a real global economic force and powerhouse as well. So Tata's success internationally, I think, is also synonymous with India's success too. So it's been very much about competition. I personally think Indians are very competitive anyway. So it's very much about, you know, emerging markets. And I think Tata has great insights into emerging markets. It has been very much about efficiencies, business efficiencies, streamlining costs. Again, very much about greater bang for buck. And I think that is very much part of the Indian way of doing business too.
We move you.
Despite its Indian roots, Tata shows a healthy respect for the brand autonomy of British companies like Jaguar Land Rover and the professionalism of their managers. In India, trust in Tata is symbolized by thousands of Tata-made lorries with colorful signs painted on their rear saying, Tata OK. Jaguar drivers in Britain are unlikely to follow suit. But they can count on emblematic British products continuing to thrive under the parental care of India's gentle giant. Tata's environmental record may be far from perfect, but its philanthropy remains unmatched by any other Indian business. The challenge in the years ahead will be to remain both profitable and philanthropic.
We can do this because people are at the forefront of everything we do. That's what the future means to us. We are Tata.
The documentary Tata, India's Global Giant, was presented by me, Zaria Masani, and the producer was Arlen Harris. A rich-